This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, June 28th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. The Jones Act has been around for nearly 100 years, and it's raised prices and harmed the U.S. economy and provided few of its promised benefits along the way. Dan Eikenson is co-author of a new Cato paper, The Jones Act, A Burden America Can No Longer Bear. The United States has had the Jones Act for 100 years.
Just about. The Merchant Marine Act of 1920. Sponsored by Senator Wesley Jones of Washington State. It was in response to what was perceived as unpreparedness for World War I, even though the war had been going on a few years before we got involved. Jones wanted to make sure that we had sea lift capacity and plenty of ships and shipbuilding capacity and a ready merchant marines to stand by to assist in times of national emergencies. So his law was intended to encourage domestic shipbuilding, and he did it in a protectionist way. So he said, the law says that cabotage, which is transporting goods from port to port, is restricted to ships that are U.S. built, U.S. owned, U.S. flagged, and U.S. staffed. And as a result of that, anything that's foreign, any ships that are foreign, cannot participate in this kind of commerce. As a result, as you would imagine, if you limit the supply of a service, then the price of that service is going to go up. And shipbuilders, instead of responding in a way that Wesley Jones may have thought they would, did what the textbooks tell you they will do, and that is they rested on their laurels. They saw no competition. They didn't innovate. And it turns out today the cost of a ship, an average seagoing ship, ocean-going vessel, is 6 to 7 times more expensive in the United States than it is on the world market. So what that has done is U.S. companies that have purchased these U.S.-built ships are on the hook. They've spent a lot of money on their ships, so they have to charge very high rates. And they don't want competition from companies that can buy ships at the world market price. So they're on board with preserving the Jones Act. So there's this very pernicious alliance between the shipping companies and the shipbuilders.
How much shipping is done intrastate via boat around the United States?
Very little. Something like 2% of our shipping, because of these restrictions, is done in the ocean, whereas 40% in Europe, where they allow cabotage among the member states.
So you could imagine some shipping between Texas and Florida that is being done one way now that might be much more competitive to do in a different way. And of course, we have a huge ocean front facing parts of the United States that might prefer to ship differently. So beginning to tally up the cost, let's just the economic costs of the Jones Act, where should we start?
Well, let's start with the shipping rates themselves. They are much higher because of the cost of shipping, because of the operational costs. U.S. crews are very expensive. You know, they're unionized. They get all the bells and whistles. That's just the primary effect. But so what does this do? If you have demand for shipping products in the United States, you say, well, I'll go to rail or trucks. So you look at I-95 on the East Coast or I-5 on the West Coast, congested with 18-wheelers all the time. And a lot of that cargo could be moved on the water and should be moved on the water. In fact, the environmental costs of switching from ocean-going vessels to trucks and rail are considerable in the billions of dollars per year, because ships emit the least amount of carbon, trains the next, and the trucks are the most significant emitters of carbon dioxide. And the planes do a little bit more, but not a lot of cargo is shipped by planes because of the Jones Act, except if you're in a place like Hawaii and you need to get something to the United States. We have this Colin Graybaum, one of the co-authors of this paper we're doing, my colleague, has found that the cattle ranchers in Hawaii have been putting their cows on planes because it's cheaper to get them to the continental United States.
That seems highly unlikely, right? In a market environment, that seems like that's not how that would happen.
It's not supposed to happen. Interestingly, Hawaii and Alaska and Puerto Rico and other U.S. territories are most adversely affected by this because they can't really substitute to trucking or rail. But the entire congressional delegation from Hawaii and the entire congressional delegation from Alaska is on board with the Jones status quo. And there's even one other point to raise here. There's a law in Alaska, which Colin came across, that requires the governor to lobby Congress for Jones Act repeal. That's one of their laws in the state of Alaska. So I guess he doesn't know that he's breaking the law by remaining silent.
So in terms of shipping, it raises shipping costs. It raises the price of ships, and it makes shipping relatively less flexible in the sense that, well, yeah, maybe I could take this ship and go to Mexico, back to Florida, et cetera, but because of the restrictions, because I've spent so much on this ship, I'm going to go exclusively between Puerto Rico and the U.S. or Florida and Texas, or my routes are defined.
They're defined, and there's no competition, right? The foreign ships can't do cabotage. They can't go to port to port in the U.S. They can go to one port, but they can't go to the next port. They can't pick up cargo and go to the next port. Those costs and then the transportation costs associated with higher trucking rates and higher rail rates. Then there are the environmental costs. It's the carbon emissions, things like that. There's also the lost wages and output of people wasting time in traffic. There's a lot of traffic. And I've seen some of the studies we've looked at show something like $100 to $200 billion a year of lost wages and output in because of traffic. Now, some portion of that is attributable to the Jones Act. There are also lost revenues to U.S. businesses who can't even engage in interstate commerce. A hog farmer in North Carolina, for example, finds it more efficient, more affordable to import grain for his hogs from Canada or Brazil than from Iowa because of the cost of Jones Act barges coming down the Mississippi River. And on top of that, U.S. exporters could have many more sales abroad, but foreign governments are less willing to open up certain parts of their markets that are currently closed because they've been demanding that the U.S. Repeal or reform the Jones Act for years. They want to compete in this market, and because we've been unwilling to do that, they're unwilling to open their markets, and that's coming at an opportunity cost to the U.S. economy. And we've set our sights on estimating what those costs will be, and we think that they're in the high tens of billions of dollars a year.
So you when you think about the deregulation of shipping that occurred in the late 1970s, that was rail and trucking.
Mm-hmm.
The Jones Act almost seems like the forgotten third part of that deregulation of shipping that occurred.
Right.
I spoke to Peter Van Doren about the deregulatory record of Jimmy Carter
right. And
how strong it was. Peter pointed to some research that said, those two deregulations of – and they, I guess, deregulated air travel as well.
Yeah, yep.
But those two deregulations of shipping are still contributing a not insignificant amount of GDP growth every year.
Yeah. If you think about it, transportation is a component of the price of everything that we purchase, everything tangible at least. Everything that is on a retail store shelf had to get there somehow. And the fact that trucking and rail got more competitive has helped to moderate final prices, transportation costs, and as they're reflected in final prices. But the Jones Act's persistence has at least enabled it has precluded or retarded the positive effects of trucking and rail deregulation because they're able to raise their prices as a result of this. So there are all sorts of downstream interests that are adversely affected by this, including the retailers. And beyond that, there are infrastructure costs, for example. We just widened the Panama Canal, finished the project a couple years ago to get these wide post-Panamax cargo ships through. In the United States, only 7 of 44 ports on the East Coast and Gulf Coast are deep enough to accommodate these ships. They need to be dredged. And there's really just one dredging company in the United States that does the seaports. And it's telling all the ports to wait in line. And the Jones Act affects dredging because when you dredge something, you're collecting what's called valueless material, putting it in the dredge, and you have to dump it. You dump it out, a couple miles out at sea. But doing that, you're moving valueless cargo, silt, from a port out to the ocean, and that puts you within the jurisdiction of the Jones Act. Those types of projects are nipped in the bud. Trump's been talking about a $1 trillion infrastructure project. The persistence of the Jones Act will make sure that that $1 trillion of spending will get us just a couple hundred billion dollars worth of infrastructure.
The Jones Act, is it fair to say that it's left Puerto Rico ill-prepared to deal with a substantial natural disaster? And it certainly contributed to their economic woes, but nailing down what those costs are and, perhaps how many deaths could be attributed to those kinds of restrictions is probably difficult to get at.
Yeah, kind of macabre, but absolutely, there's a link. The Jones Act gets attention when there are natural disasters, hurricanes and oil spills and things like that. I mean, just think about it. There was demand for so many supplies in Puerto Rico last year, but only a few ships that could be put into service. Trump did grant a 10-day waiver, but you have to realize when the president is approached with waiver requests for the Jones Act, the Jones Act defenders, even if it's a humanitarian situation, are out there lobbying, saying, no, don't give in. You can't give in. You need to preserve this. It's their life's mission to preserve this very costly provision. And they justify it on national security grounds. I think it makes our national security – it imperils our national security because we don't really have a ready force. For all of our military deployments, we've depended heavily on foreign flagged vessels to get our materiel to where it needed to be. And this just needs to go away.
It's a trade restriction exclusively on Americans in a sense. I mean, I guess it impacts trade elsewhere, but it is a profound effect, a profound trade restriction among Americans.
Yes, just like tariffs or just like the Buy American provisions. It limits the supply of something, and and then you look at all these spillover effects that we just discussed: the infrastructure, the environmental costs, the lost wages, the lost sales. People don't see it. It's just another classic example of how protectionism sort of manifests itself in an insidious way. You see you're supposed to say, hey, here's the protected industry and look how well it's doing. But even in this case, that protected industry is teetering.
We've referred to this sort of obliquely, but the foreign ships can come to a port in the U.S., but they cannot then go to other ports.
They can go to another port, but they can't pick up cargo. So they can't participate in the domestic commerce. They can't pick up cargo in Boston and take it to Philadelphia.
So they can drop off
in Boston and Philly.
So they can't make full use of their ships if they're dealing with the United States.
Exactly. There's a capacity utilization issue here. So if they bring stuff to the United States, they drop it off in one place, or they drop a portion in Philadelphia, another portion in Boston, and some in Charleston. But each stop, they have more open, unused capacity, and that's there's a cost to that.
So that it's more presumably some of those benefits of protection that are delivered to U.S. shippers might be realized in lower prices for goods that Americans bring in from overseas, just by virtue of the fact that the shipping has dramatically come down in cost because the shippers who are foreign can recoup a lot of the costs of shipping by shipping other things intrastate or interstate.
Yeah. No, it's like, you take a taxi from Virginia to Washington and he can't pick anybody up in Washington, but needs to go back to Virginia to pick somebody up.
I remember those days.
Yes. So, you mean pre-Uber?
Yeah.
So, yes, we need competition, and we need, the Europeans, the Koreans and the Chinese produce something like 70,000 gross tons of ships per year. We're at less than 1%, or about 1% of that. We're way down the list. So if the Jones Act was designed to, foster this robust industry, every year we're falling further and further behind.
Dan Eikenson is co-author of The Jones Act, A Burden America Can No Longer Bear, out now from the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.